The Dhamma for today is determining the true teachings of the Buddha. So we give special privilege to the teachings of the Buddha. We take refuge in the teaching of the Buddha, refuge in the Buddha and his teachings. The authenticity of the Buddha's teaching is of great importance. We have all these books and we have teachers and we've heard the teachings, but we have to be concerned and we have to have a certain amount of certainty that what we're following is actually the Buddha's teaching. This is a concern and a issue for those undertaking to practice the Buddha's teaching. It's a question whether what we're practicing is actually the teachings of the Buddha. Whether what we've been told is the teaching of the Buddha, what we read is the teaching of the Buddha, or even based on what we've been told and what we've read, are we understanding it correctly? And are we putting it into practice correctly? What we're practicing, is it actually the following the teachings of the Buddha? So the Buddha gave this teaching to his stepmother, his aunt, Prajapati Gotami, who had become a bhikkhuni. She was the first female monastic, and she came to the Buddha. She was, of course, older in comparison to many of those who had come to ordain, and so she asked for a brief teaching, a summary teaching. And this is what the Buddha chose to give to her. Criteria, those qualities by which we can know whether something is the teaching of the Buddha. So a very general outline, which makes it a great general teaching, to something for us to keep in mind, a teaching that is valuable on a broad base, something that all Buddhists should remember and reflect upon as a means of knowing whether we have heard and learned and are practicing something that which is actually the teaching of the Buddha. So there are eight qualities by which we can know that whether something is the true teaching of the Buddha. The first is viraga, whether the teaching or whether that which is being presented leads to dispassion. Dispassion is a key quality of the teachings of the Buddha, and an important distinction, because passion is such a highly valued quality for worldly beings. For most people, passion is something that we are taught to embrace, taught to cultivate. And the more common path is that of cultivating and embracing passion, following your heart and being passionate, or doing that which you are passionate about, and approving of that sort of passion. It takes a great depth and profundity of wisdom and understanding to see the value of dispassion, and to lead one to give up one's passions, or to give up one's attachments in this way. Without the direct practice and the systematic practice of mindfulness, it's not likely that one will be able to deeply appreciate the idea of being dispassionate. Dispassion seems to many people to be uninteresting, to be not a good thing. But through the practice of mindfulness, as we see things clearly as they are, as we pay attention and are aware of experiences arising and ceasing, we come to see the incessant nature of the objects of our passion, the objects of our desire, the objects of our aversion, and our passion about our passion in terms of greed and desire, and our passion in terms of anger and aversion. We come to see the stress that these emotions cause. We come to see the stress caused by our passion through the repeated and systematic, methodical application of mindfulness. We find ourselves becoming dispassionate by our very nature. So this is a distinction that we can make if someone is talking about cultivating passion or appears to be encouraging or promoting passion in terms of lust and desire, or in terms of anger and rage and hatred and so on. These emotions, these passions are not the teachings of the Buddha. And an important one, again, because it's not easy to see the value of dispassion. Passion is something that is prized. And it's, of course, as a result, leads the world to be on fire and in conflict and disarray and chaos and in great suffering because of our passions, because of our dedication to being passionate and falling into rage and lust and getting caught up in conflict and stress and so on. The second quality is visang yoga, freedom from bondage. We can know that something is the teaching of the Buddha because it helps release us, or it is guiding us to release from bondage, to freedom. Freedom, of course, is the cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching. But what it means, what we mean by freedom, of course, is freedom from bondage, freedom from slavery. The average individual who is caught up in passion and things like that is enslaved by their desires, enslaved by their aversions. They have no free will, no capacity to choose. And they find themselves triggered and unwillingly subject to the power and the influence of their defilements. When they want something, they're unable to prevent themselves from chasing after it. When they don't want something, they're unable to prevent themselves from being upset and enraged and frustrated and angry, sad, depressed, slave to the emotions. We find ourselves bound to people, bound to things, bound to external objects as well, based on these emotions, based on our attachments. We find ourselves living in the world, we find ourselves building up bondage, being bound by the debts that we have to society, the debts that we have to other people, based on our engagement and our following the path of bondage. So the Buddha's teaching, and through the practice of mindfulness, we following the Buddha's teaching, we free ourselves from this bondage. This is the direct consequence of seeing things clearly as they are. We free ourselves from the passions, we free ourselves from defilements. We free ourselves from bondage. We are able to stand our ground in the face of things that are desirable, in the face of things that are undesirable, not being caught up or entranced or intoxicated by greed and by attachment to these things, or aversion and hatred to the things that we don't like. We're able to find peace even in the face of great chaos. not bound by the vicissitudes, by the changes of life, by gain or fame or praise or pleasure or their opposites, loss, infamy, blame and suffering. Not being bound is a cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching. It's something that you can use as a guide for what is and what is not the Buddha's teaching. If something is leading you to be more bound, more enslaved to internal emotions or external objects, enslaved to other people even, to their whims, to their emotions, to their defilements, this is not the Buddha's teaching. The third quality is apachaya. Apachaya means something like unmaking, disassembling, tearing down, casting off. The opposite of gathering and building and constructing. We construct our own cages. We construct our prisons. In the world, worldly ambitions and worldly goals all involve the building up of constructs in our mind, is building up our personality, building up complex states of mind, complex ideas, complex emotions, and a whole personality. And of course externally we build up as well. We build up our possessions, our status, our position in society. We build up debt, we build up commitment. We build and build and build and we create, and when we die we leave it all behind anyway, but we've wasted all this time building and creating, and all we get to take with us is the personality, the qualities of mind that we have constructed throughout our lives. So the Buddha's teaching is for tearing down, for simplifying. The best way to understand it is to live a very simple existence, to relate to reality in a very simple way. This is how we understand the greatness of mindfulness, in that it provides us with the simplest of experience. That seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, feeling is just feeling, thinking is just thinking. Anything we experience is just an experience. When we remind ourselves seeing, or pain, or thinking, or anything like that, this is the simplest state. It is the casting off and the giving up of all of the extrapolation and the conceptualization that occurs in normal life, where we make more out of everything and build things up to be problems and issues and possessions, and we identify with things and we judge and react to everything. The Buddha's teaching is for tearing down and simplifying. If anyone gives you a teaching that is, or leads you on a path that is just leading you to build up and build up and become more and to gain more and to complicate your life more, then you can say, well, this is not really the Buddha's teaching. This is not likely to be the core or the base of the Buddha's teaching, not based on the teachings of the Buddha. The fourth quality is apicchata. Apicchata means fewness of needs or desires. Obviously the Buddha's teaching teaches us to give up all desire. Desire isn't something valuable, but this term relates to more to the idea of needs. It relates to what we need to be at peace, what we need to be happy. And so the opposite is mahichata, which means having great wishes or needing so many different things. The Buddha's teaching is to decrease our needs and our desires. We all need things to survive, but to keep our needs at a minimum and to not have great wants for this or that, not have great ambitions. Anything, even ambition in a religious or spiritual sense, isn't the teaching of the Buddha. If someone has ambition to become famous, a famous teacher, or someone has ambition to be a great teacher or a great practitioner or this or that. This isn't the teaching of the Buddha, to become a great person or something like that. But any kind of desire, any kind of attachment, anything that we want for ourselves, this is against the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha taught us to be simple, to be content, obviously. So in general, obviously, desire is something that the Buddha taught against, but more specifically, in regards to what we need to be happy, we can think of it as a general principle that the less we need to be happy, the more in line with the Buddha's teaching we are. The more things that we need to be happy, that we need to acquire and maintain and so on, the less we're less in line with the Buddha's teaching we are. The fifth quality is santuti, which is of course related. Santuti means contentment, so related to having fewness of wishes. Somewhat, you know, very similar. But contentment is, as a quality, is a great reminder for us to about how we should approach or how we should relate to experience, how we should relate to reality. So contentment is something that is understood to be a state of mind when you're in a state where you have nothing that's bothering you. And so for most people, the idea of contentment is a temporary thing, something that they think they have because temporarily they're satisfied. So when nothing is bothering you and nothing you're missing and nothing you wish were gone, you know, when you're okay with the things that are in existence and you're okay with the things that are not in existence, not wanting something that isn't or wanting to be free from something that is, this we think of as contentment. And it's a good definition, except the problem is that for most people this is a very, again, very temporary experience. So you couldn't say someone is content just because temporarily nothing is bothering them. But when a person is truly unbothered by experiences, has nothing that they don't want and nothing that they want, then you can say they're content. So the Buddha's teaching is for this sort of contentment, where anything that arises doesn't bother them, and anything that disappears, the disappearance also doesn't bother them. Loss doesn't bother them. Gain of unpleasant experiences also doesn't bother them. When we're no longer bothered by our experiences, this is a state of contentment. Contentment is another cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching, a very integral part of the teachings of the Buddha. So something that we can use again as a test for whether something is the teaching of the Buddha is whether it relates to contentment, or does it rather involve being partial to experiences or being triggered, being upset by this or that. Does it address this issue of being upset by experiences? The true teaching of the Buddha allows us to face every experience, not be disturbed by unpleasant or pleasant experiences, to be at peace and to be independent. Anisito jo viharati, to dwell independent of whatever changes come to us, whatever experiences arise or cease. The sixth quality is paviveka, seclusion. Seclusion is a cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching. It's obviously a conceptual idea. The idea of being secluded physically from other beings and from society, but it is an integral part of how the Buddha taught and what he advocated, what he encouraged for his students, that we should separate ourselves, that we should physically find seclusion. The idea is that our practice is about introspection, it's about self-discovery, it's about understanding the nature of experience. And experience is a very personal thing. No one else can share in your experience. Everyone else's experience is independent and separate from your experience. So engaging with other people, not only will it not help you understand your own experience, but it's likely to distract you from that process. in order to relate with others and engage with other people, other beings, you have to engage in conceptualization. You have to talk in terms of people and places and things and ideas. And you have to leave behind and be distracted and diverted from your own experience of reality. You're caught up in the emotions of the other individual, their manipulations, their weaknesses, their failings. You're distracted by them. So unless the person is someone who is truly on the right path, it's not likely to be of great benefit to spend much time with them. The Buddha taught that friendship and companionship is crucial, is a crucial aspect of our spiritual life. But that simply means that we have to be very careful with who we associate. I mean, the people that we associate with should encourage us towards introspection, towards seclusion, towards looking at ourselves rather than paying attention to the actions and activities of others. Seclusion of body is one thing. Seclusion of mind, of course, is something that the Buddha taught very seriously. Not only did the Buddha teach us to be secluded in body, but he also taught us to seclude our minds from defilements through the practice of mindfulness, through the practice of meditation. We come to free our minds, to separate our minds away from the reactions that control ordinary states of experience. Through the development of mindfulness, the development of meditation, our minds become pure. We're able to experience things just as they are, without the judgment, without the reaction. And this is considered a sort of seclusion, a mental seclusion. So these are the sorts of things that the Buddha taught. The Buddha didn't teach us to get caught up mentally or caught up physically. But viveka really means seclusion from other individuals. But seclusion of mind is of course an integral part of the Buddha's teaching as well. And if any teaching teaches you to get caught up in society, caught up in other people, sanghanika, the Buddha said, this is not the Buddha's teaching. Getting caught up in society is not following the Buddha's teaching. But on a deeper level, of course, seclusion of mind, if you're getting caught up in defilements, caught up in greed and anger and delusion, this is also very, very clearly not the Buddha's teaching. The seventh quality, viryārambha. Viryārambha. Virya means energy or effort. Ārambha means initiation or establishment. It means to maintain energy, so or maintain effort. This is a quality of the Buddha's teaching, is that the Buddha taught us to have steadfast effort, to not give up, to not throw in the towel or let ourselves be defeated. To not admit, to not give up the practice. So, the idea of effort is an integral part of the Buddha's teaching. But it's important to recognize that it's not about control. Often, application of effort feels forced, and those who are dedicated to effort are often pushing themselves, forcing themselves to become something based on one's desires. And this isn't right effort. This isn't really what the Buddha was describing. Effort should in some ways feel effortless when it's perfect. It should feel natural. Effort is the eradication of laziness, sloth, and torpor. As long as your mind is free from that, you can understand that you have right effort and that your mind is balanced in the right way. But the idea of viryārambha means not giving up. So when you have this right effort, when you are practicing, to continuously practice, to repeatedly apply the cultivation of mindfulness and of meditation. So if we find ourselves in a state of mindfulness, if we are able to cultivate mindfulness, we should repeat and take as a habit that practice. never giving up, never letting go, never faltering. A cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching is the cultivation of effort. Vidyena dukkhamajjayati, the Buddha said, through effort we will become free from suffering. So we can know that if a teaching is encouraging us to be lazy, obviously this is not the Buddha's teaching, or if there is the allowance for giving up and taking a break. You know. In the practice of meditation, we need to take breaks. You should never practice back to back to back, repeatedly walking and sitting. There should always be a break in between sessions. But that break should be done with mindfulness. Mindfulness is not something you should ever take a break from, except when you're sleeping. All of your waking hours, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you fall asleep at night, should ideally be engaged in the practice of mindfulness. This is what it means to have viryarambha. It means effort that is relentless or unflagging, or that you initiate again and again and again consistently, applying the mindfulness again. You can find your mind is distracted and you lose track of the practice from time to time. But the simple practice of reapplying your mind, trying again. Viryarambha is this act of try and try again, where you don't give up no matter how much you fail, no matter how challenging or difficult it becomes. It doesn't mean you push harder trying to force your mind to be energetic or to force success or something like that. When you fail, when you mess up, when you make mistakes, you try again. This is what true effort is, to never give up and to always try and try again. Even when you fail, even when it's hopeless, even when you're not succeeding, to continue and to persevere. This is the cultivation of effort. So perseverance is a cornerstone there. The eighth quality is subharata. Subharata means not being a burden or being of little burden to others. This is a teaching that is mostly directed towards monastics, because a monastic is someone who gives up society, gives up engaging in a worldly livelihood and collection of wealth. So in many ways they become helpless, they become subject to the whims and subject to the kindness and generosity of others. And so it's very easy to become burdensome, to become a burden towards others, and to become even parasitic. A monastic should dedicate themselves to having fewness of wishes and to being easy to care for, and not being a burden on others. When a monk goes on alms round, the reasoning for the alms round is to receive food that is given willingly by those looking to be generous, looking to do an act, a spiritual act of charity. So for many people this is an aspect of their spirituality. For most Buddhists, monastic or otherwise, charity is an important part of our spiritual practice. And so looking for those people who are, accommodating those people who are looking to cultivate generosity, is considered to be burdenless. This person who goes on alms round, and this monk who goes on alms round and receives food given intentionally, out of the initiated by the desire of those wishing to give, this is a burdenless gift. This is like the Buddha said, like the bee taking the pollen from the flower doesn't harm the flower. On the other hand, it is possible that a monastic can, as I said, become a great burden, become parasitic if they are picky and choosy and greedy and hinting and suggesting and asking for gifts and that sort of thing. They can become a real burden on others, and without giving anything back, they can find themselves greatly in debt, karmically in debt to others. But this goes as well for Buddhists and meditators in general. Obviously, those at a meditation center should strive to be content and easy to care for. They should not be picky. Obviously, we don't get to choose what sort of food we have, the room, the bedding, all many things are out of our control. And well, we want to be reasonably comfortable and accommodated, so that our practice carry on successfully. But on the other hand, we have to be careful that we don't become a burden to the meditation center. Meditators should, of course, help out, and we instruct our meditators to take part in monastic activities, cleaning and sweeping and caring for the monastery, so that we're not a burden, so that we're not burdensome, requiring other people to care for us and look after us like a hotel or something. Meditators and Buddhists, we should be conscientious of the burden that we are towards our teachers, to not waste their time or take too much of their time or disturb them with idle questions or idle chatter. Our questions and our speech and our behavior should be to the point and purposeful and necessary. And obviously, we shouldn't be a burden towards others, towards our teachers, towards the monastics, towards other Buddhists as well. We shouldn't be a burden towards our parents. We shouldn't be a burden towards society. Buddhist teaching is to be not a burden unto others. This is a cornerstone of the Buddhist teaching. That whereas we are independent, so we don't require other people. We don't require the accommodations of others. We take things as they come. As Buddhists, we're comfortable with whatever we get or don't get. If we get food, we're comfortable. If we don't get food, we're comfortable. Same with lodging and robes and medicines. And though we seek out these things as appropriate, we don't chase after them or push for them or manipulate others in order to get them. We free ourselves from being a burden, or we free others from the burden that we might present to them. So these qualities the Buddha outlined as being good criteria to understand what is the Buddha's teaching. This is a valuable teaching in general, obviously, for our lives, to be able to compare any teaching that we receive, but it's also a good outline to give us a good picture of what is the Buddha's teaching, so what we're aiming for and what we're practicing for, so that during our practice, as we interpret the teachings that we are given and implement them, put them into practice, we can ask ourselves whether we're actually practicing correctly. Am I interpreting this correctly? Am I understanding this correctly? Well, you can understand if it's leading to these eight things, if it's leading to dispassion, if it's leading to freedom from bondage, if it's leading to giving up and deconstructing the constructs of life, if it's leading to fewness of wishes, if it's leading to contentment, if it's leading to seclusion, if it's related to effort, the cultivation of effort, and if it's leading to, or if it's related to, or includes not being a burden on others, then you can understand that you're following the Buddha's teaching, and the teaching that you are practicing is in line with the Buddha's teaching. This is how we should understand what is the true teaching of the Buddha. So that's the Dhamma for today.